be discussed. They'll be aired in front of the world's media. Can you imagine the press conferences and things? I'm sure the king will be, I'm sure it'll be quite interesting, if I can say that.
Right. I mean, and also for the Liberal Democrats and for you, James, where do you go from here? At the moment, King Charles is going and the special relationship will be discussed and no doubt the Prime Minister hope enhanced. Is that not something you can get behind?
I mean, what is left of the special relationship is a very good question at the moment. Donald Trump clearly has no respect for that whatsoever. He doesn't seem to regard us as in any way special to the United States, except for getting special criticism, which seems to be all we receive from the US president at the moment. Our relationship with the United States, I think, is still very, very strong. I mean, we have huge shared cultural, historical links and, of course, a shared language. So I don't think that that's really in question right now. And it is a real shame that the US president is subverting the 250th anniversary of the United States for his own purposes in the way he is, and that will harm a lot of the celebrations that are planned in the US, because it will mean that not everybody can get behind them, because as soon as you politicise them in this way, you damage them. And I think that's the exact impact he's also having on this potential visit.
James McCleary and Grant Harrell, thank you very much for talking to us. Thank you for your company this afternoon. My production team was Lizzie Highfield and Donnie Campbell, and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Asma Mir is next.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. And coming up on today's show, both the US and Iran are declaring victory after agreeing a ceasefire. We'll get analysis from former US Ambassador Peter Galbraith. And as the Prime Minister heads to the Middle East, we'll be asking what challenges he leaves behind at home. Skincare routines are now being marketed to children as young as 8. I've been speaking to a dermatologist about the potential impact. And has your holiday ever been stunted by a strict check on your hand luggage? Well, I've got some bad news for you. Before that, the actual news with Daisy Steele.
Good afternoon. Thank you. The US Defense Secretary claims America's had a decisive military victory over Iran.
President Trump forged this moment. Iran begged for this ceasefire, and we all know it. As the president truthed this morning, a big day for world peace. Iran wants it to happen. They've had enough.
Pete Hegseth's been giving an update from the Pentagon after a 2-week pause in fighting was agreed. He went on to say Tehran had suffered a devastating military defeat. But Sunday Times columnist Mark Urban says Iran has done pretty well out of the situation.
If the 10 points that they put forward that President Trump said last night form a basis for negotiation, if they substantially get that agenda through, which includes all sorts of things that are good for them, I think many people will see it as a strategic win for Iran if the war ends on those terms.
The Israeli military claims it's hit Lebanon with what it's called its largest coordinated strike since the conflict in the Middle East began. It says 100 military sites and command centres belonging to Hezbollah have been targeted. While a temporary ceasefire in Iran has been agreed with the US, Israel's been clear this does not cover its campaign in Lebanon. Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper's called for an urgent end to hostilities there. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, will travel to the Gulf today to meet leaders of countries which have been in the front line. Downing Street says he will reiterate the need for a long-term diplomatic resolution. The Conservatives' Shadow Housing Secretary, Sir James Cleverly, says the PM has failed the UK military.
Our armed forces choose to put themselves in harm's way to defend us and our interests overseas. They have had one arm, perhaps both arms, tied behind their backs because of the indecision of the British Prime Minister. He delayed deployments of the Royal Navy. He delayed deployments of air defence assets.
The parents of 19-year-old Orla Waite says she lived life to the full following her death in a motorbike crash in Vietnam. Local media is reporting she's donated her organs. Greece is set to introduce a social media ban for under-15s. An official announcement is expected from the Greek Prime Minister later. Britain, Austria, Slovenia and Spain are also looking at banning access to sites such as Instagram and TikTok. The average price of a UK house fell by 0.5% last month. Halifax says it was the first monthly drop this year after rises in January and February. The lender says the slowdown may have been triggered by the conflict in the Middle East. And investigators have ruled the BBC broke editorial standards when a racial slur was broadcast during February's BAFTA Film Awards ceremony. The review carried out by the BBC's Executive Complaints Unit also found the breach was unintentional. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK. On DAB Digital Radio. On the free Times Radio app. Online. And on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Asma Mir in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio till 4. Now, coming up, relief all round that a two-week ceasefire has been agreed between Iran, America and Israel. And now the questions, when will the Strait of Hormuz reopen? Can the ceasefire hold? And what happens after 2 weeks? And what about Lebanon, which is not included in the ceasefire? Also on the programme, black women are apparently three times more likely to die in childbirth in the UK. What on earth is going on? And do we have to confront some uncomfortable truths? Here's another question for you. Do 10-year-olds need moisturisers with hyaluronic acid in them? Do 12-year-olds need cream with collagen or ones that repair their skin barrier? Some of the big cosmetic companies seem to think so, and they use an army of young YouTubers to sell the latest viral limited edition creams to kids who are easily influenced into spending far too much money on stuff that could actually damage their skin. So how do parents fight back against the rise of the so-called Sephora kids? And we'll round up the best TV with the critic Scott Bryan. And remember, you can get in touch too. We love hearing from you. You can text 87222. You can WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353 or email studio@times.radio. Let's have a quick look, first of all, at the most read stories on the Times website as they stand this afternoon. Number three, pedestrianise Oxford Street aiming to dodge pitfalls of La Rambla. This is Sadiq Khan's team who are taking advice from their counterparts in Barcelona, whose famous avenue is undergoing its own ambitious and disruptive regeneration scheme. They want to try and get it right, of course. The second most read story, Trump pulls back from the brink, but his reckless rhetoric has consequences. The paper's assistant US editor David Charter looks into the damage done to America's diplomatic standing. But the most read piece on the Times website is Iran war latest, no enriched uranium in deal, Trump insists. The US president spoke after J.D. Vance told Tehran to negotiate in good faith as the ceasefire deal was agreed to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. You can, of course, get all the latest updates on that page, constantly getting updated. You can read all those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, you can get one quite easily by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you are a subscriber, you can sign up to our books newsletter with news, reviews, recommendations from the Times' literary editors. It will land in your inbox every Friday at 6 as you ease your way into the weekend. Just sign up by logging into your account and looking for my newsletters. Right, it's 6 minutes, almost 7 minutes past two now. Keir Starmer is in the Persian Gulf for meetings with British allies on the front lines of the war. But while the Prime Minister is away trying to shore up our friendships with bruised international partners, politics continues at home. Oil prices may now be falling, but the economic damage of the war will take time to fade. And next month's local and national elections are expected to be extremely damaging for Labour. The Times newsroom reporter Ollie Cole is here. Hi, Ollie.
Hello.
First of all, the Prime Minister's trip, what exactly is the point of this trip?
So he's just arrived in Saudi Arabia in the last few minutes. And in part, it's a sort of catch-up exercise because he essentially has been very clear from the start that the UK is not involved militarily in this conflict. But where the Prime Minister's interests lie and where Number 10 are keen to focus is what happens next in terms of the impact that we still see on our shores here, which is the case that, you know, conflict in the Middle East has already caused huge, you know, price spikes at certain products, but that is going to have a really long tail. And a lot of it depends on the Strait of Hormuz, things moving through that strait and international shipping getting back to a more stable footing. So essentially, he's there meeting with some Gulf leaders, some UK troops who have been supporting the defensive efforts to, one, say, you know, thank you to the latter, but two, say, OK, what is the next step here? Because the UK has brought together this coalition of 40-odd countries over the last couple of weeks to basically look at how both militarily and diplomatically they can ensure a safer future. And this now two-week window will be key in that.
Mm. You alluded to it there, but what will the government be focusing on as far as the impact of the war on the cost of living, how it currently is impacting it, and the delayed impact? Because these things don't happen straight away.
No, exactly. And we know that sort of, you know, the banks update their interest rate figures sort of on, not necessarily day by day, rolling with the conflict, but monthly, quarterly, etc. And so the impact's going to carry on because you've had a load of ships waiting to get through the Strait of Hormuz. Mm. They've not been able to do that. You've now got a sort of international effort to try and get those moving. You've also got the possibility that if Iran continues to control that strait, they are looking to put tariffs on things going through there. So, for example, sort of $1 to $2 million per tanker. Most of them carry, you know, a decent amount of oil. So it probably works out about sort of $1 per barrel cost on top of that. We already know that diesel has spiked up to 190.6 pence per litre. And so, they, you know, economists think that, look, the long tail of this is, even by the end of the year, even if the best case scenario is that this two-week fragile truce, as J.D. Vance has put it, holds, you are looking at international inflation figures of still up to 3-4%. You're still looking at a big knock-on in terms of people's energy bills, in terms of things like fertilizer, products that go through that strait to get to the UK. So there is a tricky, tricky road ahead. And the Prime Minister, you know, he's made it clear from the outset that his priority, particularly with an electoral test coming up in not too long, will be on the cost of living rather than putting any troops in harm's way.
How difficult is Labour's position in the local elections? And has Keir Starmer's personal position, understanding obviously he's not, you know, who people are necessarily voting for, but has his personal position been shored up at all by his conduct, his decisions during what's been going on in the Middle East?
So he's had a little bit of a polling bump based on his decision making. It you know, it transpired. I mean, early on there was a bit of a row as to whether we should get involved with the US, how close we should be to America, and what the sort of you know, actions that the UK were taking, how that affected the relationship with America. Mm. I think in the longer term, people have realised that actually not going in with both feet with US action in Iran has been a good decision in the end. It just so happens that it's also something that the Prime Minister sort of quite squarely believes in, and that happens to be quite popular. So there's been a little bit of a bump in the polling. However, you know, these are going to be a tricky set of elections because they are midterm elections. The government is in place. They've had to make some very unpopular decisions. There's been U-turns. And like you say, even though votes in Wales, in Scotland, local councils across England aren't about electing a new Prime Minister or indeed any MPs, they are sort of seen as a bit of a litmus test as to the popularity of the government of the day. And in that circumstance, you know, Labour are going to have a tricky, tricky May election.
Now, fossil fuels are back in the headlines today. Why do Reform think that they can benefit when it comes to this particular issue?
Yeah, so this is something that Malcolm Offord and Richard Tice up in Scotland have been talking about today at a press conference ahead of the Holyrood elections. They're vowing to basically kickstart and restart North Sea oil and gas drilling if they gain the power to do so. The reason they see this as a big sort of vote winner is that there is this question politically over the last few years over how viable net zero targets are, what the impact on the cost of living is. And as people have seen energy prices go up in, you know, times of conflict, we've got the war in Ukraine still raging on, we've still got issues in the Middle East. People have sort of put to one side their thoughts about necessarily how green are we, to look more closely at their actual bank accounts and what's going out and in. So, you know, Reformer pledging that they'll be able to bring bills down. It's not quite as easy as that, because it still has to be sold on the international markets. You know, there's still quite a lot of technicalities to it. But they see this as a sort of tokenistic thing that even the government, you know, the Labour government is currently debating internally around the cabinet table, that they can take advantage of, say, look, we're going to do this one very popular thing. It'll have an impact on your energy bills because we'll be able to, you know, government will take tax take and that sort of thing, and investment from companies. And they are pretty keen to say, look, we are out front on this and everyone else is following along. Now, how that translates in reality, particularly in a Holyrood and a local election, is still remains to be seen.
Yeah. What about Wales? What are we expecting to happen there?
Well, Wales is possibly going to be one of the most interesting, you know, May election results of the whole thing, because for 100 years almost, Labour in Wales have dominated politics there. They've held the Senedd, they've had the First Minister in Cardiff Bay since the Senedd existed, first of all, as the Welsh Assembly. And opinion polling now has Labour on third, sometimes fourth, in those elections. It could be the first time that they're out. Plaid Cymru are looking to make huge gains in May. There's a possibility that they end up in coalition with the Green Party, who are looking for their first Senedd members and are pretty confident of getting a few into the chamber. And if those two were to team up, we would have a pro-independence coalition running things in Wales for the first time. Reformer also looking to make gains. They've had a few defections, but get their first elected members of the Senedd in there. So it is a tough, fractured fight for Cardiff Bay. A new voting system, a proportionally representative system, and that means that everything is up in the air. The old two-party system of Labour versus the Tories and Labour, you know, dominating Wales could very well be over in May.
Okay, Ollie, thank you for that. Very comprehensive. That's Times newsroom reporter Ollie Cole. Right, it is now 14 minutes past two. Training for NHS midwives is being overhauled, with mandatory anti-racism now set to become part of their education. Now, if you're wondering why, this is because there have been a series of maternity scandals and reviews which have highlighted what's being described as a national emergency. Wait till you hear this statistic. You might already know it. Black women in the UK are still around three times more likely to die during childbirth. The reports of black mothers being denied pain relief or urgent care after being wrongly perceived as more resilient or difficult patients. Let's speak to Sandra Igwe, who is CEO and founder of the Motherhood Group, a social enterprise that supports the black maternal experience. Good afternoon to you, Sandra.
Good afternoon.
Do you think this is going to make much of a difference?
I mean, we definitely welcome this announcement. We know that this has been something that we've been campaigning for a very long time. At least this training now acknowledges something that black women have been saying for many, many years, that we are not listened to or heard in maternity care. And at least we now know that this is a systemic issue and that this is not just a medical issue. So yes, we welcome this announcement and we welcome mandatory training for students.
Why does this happen? Because it's a scandalous statistic. Just, you know, as a bare statement, the fact that black women in the UK are still around three times more likely to die during childbirth, that's an inescapable fact. And it's something that we have to confront and ask why. So from the people that you've spoken to and perhaps your own personal experience, what kind of things actually happen that lead to these outcomes?
I mean, at the Motherhood Group, we have supported thousands of black mothers who describe their experiences as feeling dismissed or feeling like their concerns are minimized or not taken seriously. And for example, we've had countless of women reporting that their symptoms have been ignored or not been escalated very quickly, and are often told that they're exaggerating their pain or their experiences. And that leads to them not having their concerns or their challenges that are detrimental to not just their life, but their baby's life. And that leads to preventable harm and often complications and death. And what we can see is through this training is hopefully looking at biases. Why are we not listening to one mother over another? And why aren't these early warning signs being responded to in a timely manner? Why are we not being proactive, responding to complications and making sure that we're listening the first time, not the fifth or the sixth time when it's too late? And so we hear at the Motherhood Group, so many mothers, particularly Black mothers, who have said, if only they had listened to me the first time of my concerns around my baby's movements or a sharp pain in my stomach, or what does a protein in my urine mean, I would have my baby today and I would have my body intact today.
I know from experience talking to mothers who talk about the experience of childbirth on, on this radio station, that the experience kind of across the board can be difficult. However, obviously it's not as difficult. Why would, again, I think I know the answer to this, but I want to hear it from you. Why are Black women being treated differently? Is it because they are better at asking for, better at saying, hang on a second, something's not right here? Is it that there is some kind of racism or lack of education baked into the healthcare system? Or is it something else? What do you think it is?
All of the above, mainly, absolutely, covert racism, stereotyping and harmful assumptions. For example, about the pain threshold of Black women, we do know through the inquiry into racial injustice led by Birthrights Charity that I chaired that Black women are reported to have less pain relief when requesting and asking for pain relief. So it's not that Black women are not asking for support or additional help. It's when we ask for it, we either are ignored, dismissed, or our pain is minimized. I myself have personal experience of asking and requesting for pain relief and it not being given to me at all.
What I don't understand about that, Sandra, sorry, is so when you're in pain and you're asking for pain relief, someone somewhere is thinking, because you're Black, you can take the pain. I just don't, it's mind-blowing to me.
Just as mind-blowing to me as well, but we are seeing and hearing too many cases and reports of the exact same thing. In my case, I was told there was a long queue and that I wasn't a priority for this pain relief. In other cases, they are told you can get on with it or don't worry. And we do know that medical history has taught us, sadly, that Black women have, a higher pain threshold, which of course is inherently racist. We've heard from midwives directly saying, actually, Black women's skin does feel harder and tougher. And so they may be able to take injections differently. So these harmful assumptions and stereotypes are sadly putting Black women and our babies at risk.
Well, it's absolutely it's pretty shocking, actually, because if we're talking about obviously the health of a woman who's giving birth and the mortality of a child, this is pretty unbelievable, actually. I hope this makes a difference and I hope the statistics bear that out. And I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on it, Sandra, as will we. Thank you so much for talking to us. Sandra Igwe, she is the CEO and founder of the Motherhood Group. It's a social enterprise that supports the Black maternal experience. I mean, it would be interesting to speak to midwives about this. Actually, are you a midwife? Do you have some experience of this? How do you, without trying to attach any blame, how do you explain this? Because it's completely mad to think that someone, because of their racial makeup or the colour of their skin, can take more pain. Can someone just explain that to me, please? 87222, start your message with the word Times. Or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. There's some of you getting in touch on that already. Our mission is always just to try to understand what is going on rather than necessarily apportioning blame so that we can stop it happening. Now, coming up, what some sniffy flight attendants stand to gain from checking the size of your baggage. 2:21.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon, opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio. This is Times Radio.
It is 2:22 now. This is Times Radio. Asma Mir in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until tomorrow. Right, we're going to talk about travelling on planes now, because have you ever been fined for taking a bag that was just a tiny bit too big onto a plane? If so, you might have wondered why the airline staff were quite so vigilant and keen. Well, the answer is, at least in Ryanair's case, that they're paid a bonus of €2.50 for every bag they catch. And now the airline's boss, Michael O'Leary, says it's working. Let's speak to the consumer affairs expert, Harry Kind, who is in the studio. Afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
Has this ever happened to you?
Fortunately, no. I'm always slightly worried. And I've always got a like a tote bag that I can emergently kind of chuck stuff into and repackage. But I'm probably one of the people who's quite kind of grateful when the rules are enforced, because I've been following the rules so kind of vigilantly at home.
Just explain, it's been a while since I've flown on Ryanair. They don't want big cabin bags because they have less storage, or what's the reason?
They're basically trying to, it depends, you know, do we believe what Ryanair's saying or not? Because people do prefer not to check in baggage, they will bring in all of their luggage. And that is a faff when you're trying to get massive suitcases into the overhead compartments. And so Ryanair say, for free, you get a 40 by 30 by 20 centimetre box, which you're supposed to put kind of underneath the seat in front of you. That's your restriction for free.
Right.
Anything else you've got to pay for. And, you know, I can see the argument that when everyone is trying to get on in one go, there's a faff of everyone trying to put stuff in. If you have too much luggage, people have to then put that into the hold, it causes delays. And so they basically have that as an optional extra. You can pay more to get a bigger suitcase, a heavier suitcase, or to put it in the hold.
Now, look, clearly there are people who just kind of try to get away with a lot. And they're the annoying ones, really, you know, when they've got a massive bag and it's not going to fit. But some people say that actually sometimes it's just because a zip is sticking out or a wheel is sticking out. And How are you going to know, actually? Because you might measure it, but I mean, it's not the end of the world, is it? But it's 75 quid, I know that.
Yeah, and I would actually start going for a bag which I knew was going to be a little bit smaller, that there's no option at all that anything could go wrong, that you can have a wheel bigger. And you do have, you know, Primark, for example, sell Ryanair, approved suitcases in inverted commas. So that's, you know, worth looking at. But this is a massive money spinner for airlines, either by charging you more for optional baggage or by charging you when you break the rules, to the point where I think EasyJet are making £7 million every single day on ancillaries, on things that are above and beyond your kind of original ticket price. And that is the way that the industry is moving.
The consumer group Which said that the baggage policy was extremely strict, and it talked about one family of four who were charged 400 quid at the gate after they failed to check the rules. I mean, they should have checked the rules, shouldn't they?
I think we all do need to check the rules. And I think this is the kind of reminder. There's a lot of people who've been, you know, getting away with it or chancing it, and that is absolutely fine. What I think annoys some people is when this is unclear, when things seem to be, a bit haphazard, they change quite regularly. And I do think there's probably an argument to be made that if you actually enforce the rules across the board, you're going to actually stop airline staff from basically taking it out on people and saying, you know what, I don't like the look of you, you've been a bit annoying with your passport, I'm going to double check that your bag is, you know, absolutely strict. And, you know, that is actually going to benefit people by having an equal playing field. But with all of this going on, European Parliament have actually just voted to try and bring in a larger baggage size across airports in the EU. So that law could eventually pass and would mean places like Ryanair would have to let us for free have a wheeled suitcase. And that would be, you know, that would blow the whole thing apart.
But do they have the room for that?
They claim no. They claim that actually something like two-thirds of people brought the biggest bag, they would be full. They'd have to put more in the baggage claim. Mm. It would take longer. But, you know, the question is, as consumers, what are we paying for? What do we expect when we buy an airline ticket? It's not food on every flight. But it does include, you know, being able to go to the toilet. And somewhere in between those two things, right, is.
You say that now.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Michael O'Leary has talked about in the past maybe charging.
A couple of people getting in touch. The Ryanair issue is a made-up one. Listen, baggage size rules are well advertised and most bags are made to standard dimensions. Either pay for a large bag or comply. There's no catching out involved. I've no sympathy with those that break the rules and delay boarding for others, sometimes resulting in missed takeoff slots. Cough up or comply. And this one from Beaumont. I've always struggled to understand the rationale around the size and weight of the baggage that is taken on board aircraft. There are no regulations or guidance or penalties for larger passengers who would weigh substantially more than me and any baggage. Goodness me. Presumably Ryanair staff are happy about this because they had bonuses were capped at €80 and now that cap's been removed. So it's €2.50 for each bag.
Yeah, so it used to be €1.50 and you could cap at 80. Now, you know, €2.50. When you're talking at about 200,000 fines given out every year, you know, that's €500,000 in potential bonuses for staff. They will be happy. And probably there's a little bit of a kind of, you can point to it as an edict from on high and say, I'm sorry, I'm just enforcing the rules, I don't make the rules. So good for them. And particularly when reports are of just basically airline staff being abused more than ever, it is nice to put a bit of money back in their pocket.
Yeah, and what's interesting actually is it seems to be working in that fewer passengers are now being caught out. So it is, I don't know, should we all be happy all round? Because you're not paying the £75 extra. The staff are, you know, have got their bonuses and more people are abiding by the rules.
Look, the flip side of this is, and according, this is coming from EasyJet, is that if we did have a regulation suitcase size that everyone got for free, then prices would go up by 25% for our basic ticket. For a lot of people, they would consider that, you know, much better option. But for some people who are really trying to get the cheapest possible flight, and I'm thinking of myself here, I'm thinking a lot of students who would go, do you know what? I will go for the smallest possible pair of underpants and take them with me in order to get them on my plane. But as compensation, I will get a cheap ticket, which maybe I won't be able to afford.
If you're only taking your underpants on holiday, then I can't help you. Harry, thank you very much for that. As Harry Kind, consumer affairs expert. Charlie says the luggage isn't so very different from the large letter or small parcel distinction in postage. There has to be a cutoff, and perhaps like post offices, a template, it has to pass through easily. I mean, they do have that, I think, don't they? But some people still dispute it. Anyway, thank you very much for that. Right, coming up, do children as young as 8 really need skincare routines? Before that, the headlines with Daisy Steele.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth says we have a real chance at peace after a two-week ceasefire was agreed with Iran. Donald Trump says the US will work closely with Tehran and they will dig up and remove buried nuclear material, adding that there will be no enrichment of uranium. Both sides have claimed victory. Iran says it will reopen the Strait of Hormuz and that its victory in the field would also be consolidated in upcoming talks. General Lord Dannett served as head of the British Army. He says Iran seems to have emerged in the stronger position.
One's got to look at this dispassionately and actually ask the question, is the world better off? Has America made any progress over the last 6 weeks? Or in fact, is the situation where we are today worse for America than it was six weeks ago? And it's quite hard to argue yourself to the alternative.
Meanwhile, Israel says it's carried out the biggest coordinated strike on Lebanon. Its military says it's hit more than 100 sites linked to Iran-backed Hezbollah. It says the two-week ceasefire does not include Lebanon. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, will travel to the Gulf today to meet leaders of countries which have been in the front line. Downing Street says he will reiterate the need for a long-term diplomatic resolution. In other news, a British teenager has died while on her gap year in Vietnam. It's understood 19-year-old Ola Waits fell off her motorbike on the Ha Giang Loop in the north of the country. And her reviews found the BBC broke editorial standards when a racial slur was broadcast during February's BAFTA Film Awards ceremony. But investigators admit the breach was unintentional when it was uttered by a Tourette's campaigner. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
This is Times Radio.
This is Times Radio with Asma Mir sitting in for Jane and Fee. I'm here till 4 o'clock, and then it is Times Radio Drive with John Pienaar, of course. I'm sure you were very relieved, and I know you get up very early, don't you, John?
Well, I don't sleep.
Well, what time do you get up? I read somewhere you get up
My eyes are open before I get up.
Right.
Well, I'm a chronic and acute insomniac. So, but why do you ask?
Because you would have woken up and just, you would have checked whether an entire civilization had been wiped out this morning.
Well, except that came in just after 11 o'clock.
Oh, you were still up at 11 o'clock?
I was still awake at 11 o'clock.
So yeah. No sleep, basically.
Some, but not much.
No. So the wonderful news, obviously, this morning is that there's been a ceasefire, they've pulled back. Do we have any kind of idea about when and how and why the Strait of Hormuz is going to open? Who's going to operate it? Who's going to be first through?
No, I think the answer is no. but I'm going to be asking those questions and a few more, because there does seem to be this agreement, doesn't there, between America and Iran, mediated by Pakistan, that the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz is now on the table. It is a kind of an outline of a plan. Exactly how that's going to work, well, you've got the Prime Minister in the Gulf talking about that, among other things. Will we see Iran charging tolls? You know, I forget who said this. It was a nice line this morning that they've turned the Strait of Hormuz into Dartford Tunnel. So people are now going to be just paying for use of that route.
Yeah.
But how's that going to go down with, well, apart from many others, the British government paying money straight into the pocket of Tehran? Not well, I imagine. So we're going to be talking about how that's going to work out. Is this ceasefire deal a durable one? What are the terms of this ceasefire deal? Is it just, you know, basically written down by Iran, handed to Pakistan, passed on to America, and Donald Trump took it up because he wanted to end the war? He's claiming complete victory, and there's plenty of people who say, no, it's not a complete victory. It's a strategic win for Iran. Mm. So those things are more. I'm going to be talking to, yes, Catherine Philp, the Times World Affairs editor. I'm going to be talking to Aaron David Miller, who was a former Middle East peace negotiator for the United States. David Charters joining us from Washington for the Times, and Ambassador John Bolton, who is pretty hawkish about Iran, but not the way this war has been conducted. I'm guessing he's going to be pretty critical. And towards the end of the show, we're going to be at 6 o'clock, when we expect the President's Press Secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, to go to the podium in the White House. And we're going to hear more, I guess, of what an unambiguous triumph this has been for American military might. So we're looking at it and hearing from all the angles in this, and people can listen in and share their thoughts, because we want them to do that too.
Yes, absolutely. John, thank you very much for that. John Pienaar, he is here with Drive on Times Radio at 4 o'clock. Right, it is 2:36 now. Does a 10-year-old girl need a 6-step skincare routine? Should she be using retinol or creams with collagen in them? Should she be spending upwards of £50 a pop every time she goes to Sephora or Boots or Superdrug? Driven largely by social media, some brands are now marketing skincare to children as young as 8. Now, we're not talking about lip glosses and eyeshadows, which is, you know, basically a rite of passage for most 10-year-olds. We're talking about expensive, potentially damaging products that are being pushed by young influencers and packaged in pastel colours with little key charms attached. But dermatologists are warning that certain ingredients, particularly in anti-aging products, could actually do more harm than good to young skin. Now, I know many may not see this as a problem. We all dabbled with makeup. I started by asking Tess McPherson, president of the British Society for Paediatric and Adolescent Dermatology, why it might be more serious than that in 2026.
Worrying about how you look and who you are is a very normal part of being a teenager. and dabbling in certain things and maybe trying certain things out is obviously a normal part of adolescence. So it's not to say that any of this is new or particularly abnormal, but it's just what we're seeing is a really problematic increase in the amount of the pressure on young girls to both look a certain way and the pressure that to look this way you have to buy and use certain products. And this again is being played out through some of the brands and social media, and it's meaning that we're seeing young girls spending more time and more money on products which really they don't need and actually don't suit their skin and can cause problems with their skin. But also this kind of this pressure is not making any of them any happier or indeed their skin look better.
So if as a parent, or indeed not as a parent, if you stand in Sephora or Space NK or Boots or Superdrug on a Saturday, you will see so many young girls standing there absolutely shrieking at what's on the shelves, that, oh, I must have this, it's limited edition. And you see their parents kind of standing by, some of them trying to get in on, you know, on with it, like we're cool, but others are just a bit flummoxed really by the kind of the enthusiasm for this stuff and the price of it too, because it's, I know everything's more expensive than it was, you know, when we were kids, but it's, some of this stuff is ruinously expensive. I wonder if you can explain for people again who are not aware of this, or perhaps whose children are mercifully still too young for this, why does this happen? What happens on YouTube and on social media that drives these girls from their screens into those kind of stores?
Yeah, so I think there's various things that are happening on social media and, you know, in the media in general. So these are products which, as you said, are priced for very much adult prices. These are, you know, upwards of £50, sometimes even three-figure amounts for some of these creams and things. So they're priced for adults. The companies would say they are being directed at adults. But, you know, there's soft messaging which makes them very attractive to younger and younger children. They're in pastel colors, they almost feel like collector's items. And then you see on social media these young girls, and sometimes sort of in collaboration with their parents, kind of opening these packages, showing their Get Ready With Me, their multi-step programs they do for their skin in the morning and the evening. And these are things which are watched a lot, and then people feel that these are kind of attractive and needed for their lives to be, you know, like everyone else's. And again, as I said, this isn't new that teenagers want what other teenagers have. So then there becomes this peer pressure. And, you know, I hear these, as you have, I've seen in Boots or any other different pharmacies on a Saturday, young children, you know, and these things are, again, designed to be at eye level for these young children, looking at these things, wanting these things and trying to persuade their parents or saving up themselves to spend money. Mm. So it's money they don't have, money they shouldn't be spending on these products. Time is particularly, I mean, some of these, there was some recent research that looked at some of these Get Ready With Me performances, and they were using, you know, 15 different products. Some of them would have the same components in them, and some of them would again be damaging for young skin and really not needed. So it's not to say there isn't a time and a place for using topical products, but a 10-year-old does not need to be spending 40 minutes twice a day using 15 different products costing an exorbitant amount of money. It has so many risks to their mental health, their physical health, just in terms of the time they're spending doing it and the concern that then that places on how they look as being the only way to measure how they are and who they are.
I'm going to go through a list of ingredients in a second, and I don't even have them written down actually, because I've got them in my head, because you know, these are in some of the stuff that my daughter's already bought when I wasn't really paying that much attention, because I never thought that stuff that was aimed at kids would have those kind of ingredients in it. But before I do, presumably, so my daughter's 10, I've spoken to many other people whose daughters are around the same age, and they say, yeah, absolutely. Not one of them has said, no, she's not interested. So they kind of all seem to be quite interested in it. Presumably there is a place for a 10-year-old or 11-year-old girl to have a routine that maybe involves something more than soap and a flannel. So it involves, you know, cleansing your face at the end of the day, cleaning it with whatever, some kind of little foaming fruity thing, and then putting a moisturizer on and maybe some SPF or something like that. Presumably you have no problem with that.
Obviously, I am a dermatologist. The skin is the most important organ of the body, and I see people who have skin conditions, problematic skin, and how much that can affect them. So absolutely, yeah. Caring for your skin and recognizing its importance is a key part of what I do and what I believe in. But I don't think you need to spend very much time or money. And for the vast majority of 10-year-olds, really need to do very little at all. They need to wash. They maybe need to moisturize. They maybe use sun protection.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't be much more than that. Obviously, I see people with skin conditions who, these products can be even more problematic if you're prone to eczema or something. And then they feel kind of excluded. And it's increased stigma on them. Because if skin, or a particular type of skin, which we know is not achievable or even normal, this kind of perfect skin or flawless skin, which I hear people talk about,
like it's something which is
normal and we should all be trying to get. And so not only is that problematic for the people that don't have actual skin problems, it's really problematic for the people that are suffering with acne, eczema, psoriasis, or a whole wealth of skin conditions, which they don't get because they're bad people.
Yeah.
They get because they're struggling with their skin anyway, and maybe do need to use slightly more different products or do need to have some support and advice on how to manage their skin. I'm now being told by lots of parents, oh, my daughter wants to be a dermatologist. She's so into skincare. Right. And again, not that skincare is a problem, but it's not what I see what dermatologists should be doing is managing people with skin problems, not telling the world that glass skin or perfect skin is the only way for skin to be.
Right, here's some things. Can you tell me whether or not these are appropriate for a 10 or 11 or 12 year old girl? Retinol.
So retinol is a very useful topical product if you either have spot-prone skin, which, again, some 10-year-olds might have. So that's maybe possible that they may need a retinol, but unlikely. And it does have some benefits if you have older skin. So retinol for most 10-year-olds, absolutely not needed. It's an irritant. All these products will cause irritation. I see lots of young people who have eczema-prone skin who are using these products and making their eczema really problematic.
Retinol, generally no. I can never really pronounce this. Hyaluronic acid.
So again, hyaluronic acid has some properties in moisturizing, some properties if you're an older person, but really for younger skin, not necessary. Can cause irritation, can cause problems.
Collagen.
Not needed.
These are actual
minimal
real
evidence. Minimal evidence, yeah. For anyone, actually.
These are real life examples from my house. But anyway, something called squalane.
Again, this is just a moisturizer, really. It's a fancy moisturizer. I mean, the problem is that many of them will irritate the skin. And if you've got younger skin, then that's going to be more problematic. But some of them can cause, contact allergies, which can be lifelong. So they can definitely cause issues to the skin. But I think the bigger issue is something we all have to address is what is this saying about society, that young girls feel they have to be buying these products and have to feel the pressure to look a certain way to be happy? And we can see it's not making anyone any happier.
Finally, if you're a parent of one of these children and the mania on a Saturday is huge, it's let's go to Sephora, let's go to big shopping centre, let's get this stuff, let's go to Space NK, whatever. I'm not sure, once it started, how do you stop it?
I think it's sensible parenting. I mean, for a 10-year-old, you do have some capacity to work with them and help them manage what they're doing and how they're doing it. I think it's trying to be sensible. It's trying to obviously accept these are things that they are interested in and other people may be doing. But, that's like all these things. It is about what does your skin need? It probably doesn't need very much. No, I'm not going to be spending that much money on skincare products which you don't need, which might be dangerous. But also looking at how they react to social media and how they engage with social media, to a degree, managing social media in a sensible way, in a way that, doesn't make you feel bad is a thing we all need to do. I mean, I'm increasingly thinking for under 16s that they should not be signed up to social media. And certainly if my children were young, I would be advising that. But it's also looking at other things to do, other activities that might make them feel good, physical exercise, join a team, do something else. Don't just focus on, and I think we all do this, is again, talking about their looks as if that's who they are. We all need to look at other characteristics of people and not just talk, particularly with girls from when they're very young. I think we all do this. We focus on what they look like rather than other characteristics. And that's something we should all be working on as well. So being a sensible parent, standing up to some of the pressure, just like with social media, this is something parents are going to have to lead on. 10-year-olds are children. They need our help and they need to be given sensible parenting and sensible adulting so that they don't think it's normal to be putting anti-aging products on when they're 10.
That was Tess McPherson. She is president of the British Society for Paediatric and Adolescent Dermatology. Simone has got in touch. Maybe these indulgent parents just said no and didn't just spend on these girls because it takes less time than engaging with them. We wouldn't be wasting airtime on 10-year-olds whose parents encourage them in this glass skin rage. Parents need to say no. Of course they do. What I would say, though, is a couple of things. Number one, children will always bond over certain things. It might be, you know, it used to be, like, I don't know, Madonna, pop stars, whatever. You know, then it goes on to something else. Squishies, that's what they're into. They are also into a little bit of makeup and a little bit of skincare, and they take the products in. It's like a little, tiny little pot of lip balm or whatever, and they all pass it round and they all squeal over it and they bond. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. The problem is they're incredibly suggestible. And the whole point of an influencer on YouTube or wherever is that they influence these young girls to go and buy the products. And all I would say, Simone, is honestly, once you're in it, it's quite difficult. A lot of the stuff that my daughter bought, when I realised what it was, it went in the bin. And now we have rules. But I'm not going to say to her, you can't have any moisturiser, because that genie is out of the bottle. I'd be really interested to hear from you if this is something that is going on in your house. Maybe you're in the middle of it and you don't know what to do about it, or maybe you found the solution to it. I'd love to hear. 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can always WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. Right, coming up, why children's channel CITV is closing after 40 years on air. It is 2:48.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
McDonald's cards are here. 24 cards to find and free food in every pack. Enter cards in the McDonald's app and complete sets with over £4 million in cash prizes to be won. McDonald's cards. 18 plus UK only. With selected meals subject to availability. Ends 27th of April. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Right, this is Times Radio. I'm Asma Mir, and we are going to talk TV now, because the legendary children's TV channel CITV will officially close after 40 years on air. The ITV children's channel kickstarted the careers of well-known names like Ant and Dec and Holly Willoughby, of course. Scott Bryan is a TV critic to the stars, it says here, and joins us now.
It's a lot to unpack, isn't it?
No, I'm really building you up. Joins us now for all our telly news. You've obviously got a very good skincare routine going on as well, I just want to say. Let's talk, shall we, about CITV first of all. I mean, 40 years, that's going to make everyone feel a bit old, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was in the generation of viewers who watched My Parents Are Aliens, Art Attack. The mainstay, of course, the set of programmes that aired on the weekday afternoon between about 3:25 and 5:35. And then what's happened over the course of the last few years is a gentle erosion on linear, on normal traditional TV, at least. Because what we first had was that afternoon block of programmes, the mainstay for many kids growing up, moving to its own dedicated channel called CITV. Then CITV wound down. ITV moved a lot of their programmes onto their streaming service, ITVX, where, you know, there is a great catalogue of shows on there. And then it seems, at least, that from Friday, April the 10th, the last remaining block of kids' programmes will no longer be airing on ITV2, which they have done so since the channel closure. So it's potentially the end of kids' TV on ITV as a whole, with the exception of streaming, which I think, to me at least, is a bit of an alarm bell, because, of course, there is still great kids' programmes being made. It's primarily now the BBC. Mm. Channel 4 stopped many years ago. ITV have sort of cut down on the amount of commissions as well. And, of course, there's the internet and kids have been flocking to the internet in a really big way. But as your previous caller was just talking about social media use and the potential downsides of kids having a lot of time on the internet. So you're sort of wondering exactly whether the internet is the right thing for it.
So my daughter, this programme is basically fueled by my daughter, sorry, but these are all the experiences. So she doesn't watch, you know, she didn't know what linear TV was just because I suppose, I don't really know why. I that's probably my fault. Because, you know, you might have been watching Netflix or something and she would have said, oh, look, there's kid stuff on here. Can I look at that? And so there's a lot of this kid stuff on Netflix, on Disney Plus. But I tell you one thing, which is very heartening, and that is that she loves The Dumping Ground, which is that long running kind of spin off of, you know, the Tracy Beaker thing that's on ITV, that's on iPlayer. And she's absolutely addicted to that. She says those are her friends. So there is hope, but I wonder what kids actually watch these days in terms of, you know, something that's story driven.
So I would say that your daughter is not an exception. I mean, there has been a real decline in the amount of kids watching kids TV over the course of the last few years. I mean, if you look at the data from Ofcom, the regulator, a significant amount of viewers are now online and now are barely watching, you know, even maybe even a few minutes of traditional TV at all in any given week. And I think that's only going to grow up, you know, through the generations, you know, as TV becomes less of a draw. Mm. But I would also say that what has been a concern is primarily funding, because what we had in the late noughties, you know, whether you were for it, whether you were for against it, but the junk food ban had a massive detrimental effect to the amount of kids funding that they would have on commercial channels. The government did pay out, so in terms of funding themselves, as I understand it, that's cut back in a large way too. So your source of you need in TV a lot of competition. Why? Because that means that the programs are better. Yeah. And if it means that only one channel is the place that is creating that show, those shows, then even if it's good like The Dumping Ground, you need that healthy competition to make sure that kids TV will thrive for generations to come.
Yeah. Let's move on and talk about 2026, which arrives on our TVs tonight. This is for fans of W1A and 2012. I could never really watch W1A because I was working in W1A at the time. I was working at the BBC at the time, and it felt just so painfully true and not in a funny way, but I know people love it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say W1A is not a comedy, it's a documentary. Yeah, I mean, I think this is the biggest confusion about it, because for anyone who has been working in the BBC or works within the media in general, they've been in those meetings that are exactly like they've been depicted. And also, in a weird way, John Morton's comedy has been a precursor. Many things in that show have happened in real life following it actually happening on the comedy. Most notably, when BBC Three, the channel, had a revamp, like a new bit of branding. And it looked like exactly the same as what was spoofed on W1A, which is a delight. So this new series, 2026, written out as words, follows Hugh Bonneville, who is reprising his role as Ian Fletcher, looking at the upcoming World Cup taking place, of course, across North America. I mean, I would say that it's the continuation of it being a quiet agony is certainly there. I mean,
that's exactly what it is. Quiet agony.
Yeah. To anyone who's sort of worked in an office where people have incredibly lofty roles that don't really make sense, like, there's a lot of jokes and references about that. I would say, to me so far, I've not been able to get into it as quickly as W1A, purely because there's a lot of new characters. You do have Hugh Skinner as, like, the intern, the hopeless intern, Will, continuing along too. But you do miss Siobhan Sharp and just her useless PR, because, trust me, we've all been in the meeting, haven't we, like that?
Many times, often more than once a day. Finally, The Other Bennett Sister on BBC iPlayer. It's another take on the Austin classic. And I'm told this is actually one to watch because, well, just the acting is apparently fantastic.
It is. I mean, The Other Bennett Sister looks at Pride and Prejudice from a different point of view. I really like this because normally period dramas are quite stuffy. You know, the costumes and frilly hats and people talking endlessly about boys and female characters not being given enough autonomy has been a bit of a gripe. But you don't have this with The Other Bennett Sister. It's incredibly well written based off the very successful novels. But there's also a breeziness throughout the series that I really do enjoy. only 30 minutes episodes. And also, I think you have Richard D. Grant and Ruth Wilson playing the mother and father. And it's essentially about whether any of these women are able to get married, because if they don't have a male heir, then they lose the whole family fortune. And I really quite like the fact that Richard D. Grant's character doesn't give a hoot, because as he puts it, he'll be dead soon. So what does it matter to him?
The second season of The Pitt is out, and this is Noah Weil, I think I'm right in saying, playing Dr. Robbie, lead physician in the A&E department of a Pittsburgh hospital. He's, of course, best known for ER. Is this any good?
It is. I mean, it's been a long time coming. It's 441 days since it aired in the US from when it airs in the UK. Part of it was because they were holding it back for this new streaming service. That's right, another streaming service. That's right, we're going to spend more money. But HBO Max is available for free if you've got Sky, if you've got the streaming service now. And what they've done is that they've released all of the first series season, but then there's also weekly episodes. I quite like it because it's a bit like 24 for Jack Bauer intelligence series, but with knives set within kind of real time in the hospital. And I think it's the attention to detail in terms of all of the medical terms. It was quite grounded. And the thing, like, if you compare it to Grey's Anatomy, it feels very realistic. Mm. But I think it's also, like, it really has a good appreciative look of all of the frontline medical staff and the people who, in difficult times in regards to funding and stress and pressure, still ensure as much as they can that the people they look after are looked after. Mm. And, you know, there are many times when you're watching this, even if you're wincing at the sight of blood like I am, that you are thankful that in a grave time of need, there are people there for you.
Yeah, beautifully put. Scott, thank you so much for that. That's Scott Bryan, the TV critic, of course. Quite a few of you have got in touch about skincare for 8, 9 and 10-year-olds. Judy says, isn't it time we started calling influencers what they are, advertisers or even sales assistants? This is from Beryl. This may be a bit radical. Why not take the child for a personal dermatology appointment who will prescribe a basic moisturiser and SPF appropriate for their age? Bonnie says, where are these young children getting the money to pay for these expensive treatments? Some of it's pocket money and some of it, I think, the parents pay. But Tess, who we spoke to, actually made another good point. I think it didn't make the cut, but she basically said, if you can try and educate your kids that this is kind of capitalism, that these people are making a lot of money out of them and they don't necessarily believe in the products, then the scales kind of do fall from their eyes a little bit. So I don't know, maybe you could try that. Anyway, 8722, or you can get in touch by emailing studio@times.radio.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. And still to come, we'll bring you the latest from the ground in Lebanon, where Israeli airstrikes have been reported, despite Pakistan saying the ceasefire deal should apply there too. Rory McIlroy returns to the Masters, hoping to secure a historic back-to-back green jacket. And our big guest after 3:30 is Anjali Ralph, author of the best-selling book, The Boy at the Back of the Class. First, the news, Daisy Steele.
Good afternoon. Israel's launched its biggest wave yet of coordinated strikes on Lebanon. It claims to have hit more than 100 targets linked to the Iran-backed Hezbollah militant group. The US and Iran agreed a temporary ceasefire overnight, which the Pentagon claims Tehran begged for. But American military chief General Dan Kane says his forces remain ready.
We hope that Iran chooses a lasting peace. But as Secretary Hegseth said, let us be clear, a ceasefire is a pause, and the joint force remains ready if ordered or called upon to resume combat operations.
Both sides have claimed victory. Iran says it will reopen the Strait of Hormuz and that its victory in the field would also be consolidated in upcoming talks. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance admits the truce is fragile.
Some of the people have responded favorably and have said the right things. And then you have some people on social media within their system who are basically lying about what we've accomplished militarily. They're lying about the nature of the agreement. They're lying about the nature of the ceasefire.
The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has now arrived in Saudi Arabia to help push for a long-term resolution. Meanwhile, oil prices have fallen sharply today. A barrel of Brent crude has dropped to $94, but that's still above pre-war costs of about $72 a barrel. In other news, the head of NHS England says resident doctor strikes have been deliberately timed to cause havoc as a six-day walkout enters its second day. Hospitals are struggling to fill rotas, with senior clinicians cancelling leave to cover gaps, while public support for that action appears to be falling. A British teenager has died while on her gap year in Vietnam. It's understood 19-year-old Orla Waits fell off her motorbike on the Harjang Loop in the north of the country. An investigation into the BBC's coverage of this year's BAFTA Film Awards has found the broadcast of a racial slur was a clear breach of their editorial standards. The Executive Complaints Unit agreed it was a genuine mistake, given that the same word was edited out by the team later in the programme. The average price of a house in the UK fell by 0.5% in March. Analysis by Halifax suggests it was the first month prices fell this year, after rises in January and February. Last month, the average house price was just under £300,000. Bosses at the lender say the slowdown's been triggered by the conflict in the Middle East. The RSPCA says it rescued dozens of dogs from a UK home overrun by more than 250 poodle crossbreeds after their owners lost control of breeding. Officials found the property in filthy conditions, with unkempt animals and waste covering the floors as the situation spiralled out of control. The charity warns large-scale neglect cases are rising sharply and is urging people to adopt as centres struggle to cope with demand. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio till four. And coming up in the next hour, relief that a two-week ceasefire has been agreed between Iran, America and Israel. But now come the questions. When will the Strait of Hormuz reopen? Can the ceasefire hold? And what happens after 2 weeks? And what about Lebanon, which is not included in the ceasefire? We'll have a report from there shortly. And at 3:30, our big interview is with the author of the children's book, The Boy at the Back of the Class, Anjali Rauf. She's written many books, but her road to getting published was long. And what kind of issues can children cope with in books? You can get in touch by texting 87222, WhatsApping 0333 003 2353, or you can email studio@times.radio. Now, President Donald Trump has said the United States will work closely with Iran, claiming the country has undergone a productive regime change. His comments come after the two sides agreed to a temporary ceasefire and move to reopen the strategically vital Strait of Hormuz. US Secretary of War Pete Hegseth held a press conference afternoon saying that President Trump had showed mercy to Iran.
President Trump had the power to cripple Iran's entire economy in minutes, but he chose mercy. He spared those targets because Iran accepted the ceasefire under overwhelming pressure.
The US says Iran's stockpiles of enriched uranium will also be retrieved by American personnel. Hegseth said the deal would rule out any Iranian nuclear weapon.
This new regime was out of options and out of time, so they cut a deal. They know this agreement means that they will never, ever possess a nuclear weapon. Under the terms, any nuclear material they should have will be removed. Any material they should not have will be removed. Right now, their dust is deeply buried and watched 24/7 overhead. The president has been clear from the beginning, there will be no Iranian nuclear weapons. Period. Full stop. Other presidents said it. President Trump did it.
That was Pete Hegseth. Now, the ceasefire has been welcomed in a joint statement from Western leaders, including Keir Starmer, released this afternoon. They said a swift and lasting end to the war was needed, but could only come from diplomacy. Joining us now is Peter Galbraith, former United Nations Special Envoy to Afghanistan and former US Ambassador. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
How optimistic are you First of all, about this two-week ceasefire.
Well, it's certainly better than having had a massive military strike at 8 p.m. Eastern time yesterday. It didn't surprise me. There's an expression in the United States now called taco. Trump always chickens out. And so it wasn't a surprise that you had all this threatening language and then that he pulled back. Clearly, so much better for him to not go forward with something that clearly would have been a war crime. Actually, since he declared his intent was to destroy Iranian civilization, it would have met the terms of the Genocide Convention. As to whether there'll be an agreement, one can see that the basis of a deal, from Iran's point of view, nuclear weapons don't actually help. Nuclear material don't. It's simply made Iran a target. A nuclear weapon is not actually a deterrent except against another nuclear weapon. Otherwise, they're essentially unusable. Trump doesn't care about human rights or any or genuine regime change. He said that there's a new and better regime. In fact, it's no different whatsoever, except that the new supreme leader is the son of the previous supreme leader, presumably somebody who has a reputation for being more hardline and also might be quite angry about the murder of his family. Is it possible Iran might agree to something? They certainly haven't yet. Are there things that Iran can get? Yes, they would like lifting of sanctions, since there are human rights sanctions and Trump doesn't care about those. That could go. Even the possibility of economic relations between the U.S. and Iran and U.S. investment. Maybe that's a bit far-fetched at this point. But something, now that's the sort of deal that would appeal to Trump.
What's your understanding of who's going to be in charge of the Strait of Hormuz? Because Iran are going to reopen it. They closed it. They're going to reopen it. What's your understanding of will everyone be allowed through and who's in charge of charging them for getting through?
Well, first, it's an international waterway. So I don't know that. I mean, Iran has said that it would charge a toll, but that doesn't mean that it actually can. Mm. It isn't quite so that Iran closed the strait. What Iran made threats and then tankers wouldn't go through because their insurance rates went sky high. There weren't actually very many ships that were struck. It isn't an issue for the United States that U.S. ships don't go through. So will there be and oil doesn't go to the United States. So will there be shipping that goes through that's quite possible. There's no real reason for the Iranians to keep their threats up, much less fire missiles.
Western leaders have welcomed the ceasefire, but they say that only diplomacy can provide a lasting peace. Who is being diplomatic here? Because Pete Hegseth, I'm trying to be objective here, doesn't sound like he is being particularly diplomatic. Donald Trump doesn't sound like he's being particularly dramatic, but then neither are the Iranians. So where are the diplomatic voices? I mean, I presume we don't hear them.
Well, I think there are two sides to this. This was essentially an unprovoked sneak attack on Iran. So it's not surprising that the Iranians have responded with harsh words and harsh actions, of course, illegal actions, because they were attacking countries that were in no way involved in the attack on them. They adopted, however, a very effective strategy because they disrupted the global economy, including the U.S. economy, drove gas prices around the world, but particularly in the U.S. sky high, and they did political damage to Trump. That was not a stupid strategy on their part, and they've gotten Trump to back down. The question is, will they go forward and make some kind of deal that accomplishes what the United States and Israel have been demanding, which is to the elimination of the nuclear program, although it's unclear even what would be acceptable to Trump. At one point, he said, Well, we don't need to retrieve the nuclear material. We can monitor it from the air. Hegseth says that we'll go in and take it out. I don't think the Iranians have agreed to that. I would be surprised. This has been a war launched without actually having very clear objectives. One point it was regime change. Now they're saying there is regime change when there isn't. One point, it was to get rid of Iran's nuclear material, which Trump had said already had been obliterated. Hegseth saying it will be removed. Trump has said we can be monitored by satellites. All that confusion, as I think about it, certainly leaves a lot of scope for a negotiated agreement.
How has this, what's the kind of legacy of this? I mean, we're not over it yet. We're not through it. We're only, on day one of a temporary ceasefire. But once we get to the end of this, which we all hope we do at some point, what's the damage that's been done here that might have to be repaired in terms of relations with other countries?
Well, first, there's the relations between the United States and its allies, who were not informed, were not involved. You then have had the name calling by Trump, I think comparing the British prime minister to a previous prime minister, Neville Chamberlain. You've had the Spanish and the French refusing to permit American planes to fly over their territory. And this comes just a few months after Trump was threatening to invade, seize, and annex Greenland. In other words, attack a NATO ally. So obviously a lot of damage has been done to the transatlantic relationship. Damage has been done to the United States' reputation around the world. And it's not clear that anything has actually been accomplished. Iran's nuclear program was obliterated, according to Trump, in June. He did say it was so they were weak from a bomb, but in fact, there's no evidence that they resumed their program. So it's not clear there's any gain there. Now, if there's some kind of agreement, I suppose that would be a gain. It has had an impact on Iran's ballistic missile program in the sense that they've fired a lot of their missiles. But it's also been very costly to the U.S. because the U.S. has been using basically million-dollar high-tech systems to shoot down $15,000 drones. And there's no sign of any change in the regime or government in Iran, although clearly a substantial part of the Iranian population would desire that.
Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for talking to us. Very interesting. Former United Nations Special Envoy to Afghanistan and former U.S. Ambassador. Lebanon's government say that its hospitals are overflowing after a wave of Israeli attacks across the country. Israel says it was targeting more than 100 Hezbollah command centres and military sites. The attacks come despite the ceasefire between Israel, the US and Iran, which supposedly included Lebanon. Israel insists it isn't part of the deal. Karim Chehayeb is a journalist at the Associated Press based in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. Hello to you, Karim.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Just tell us what is happening. What's happening in Beirut? What's happening in the rest of Lebanon right now?
So this morning was definitely an interesting one, given the question of whether Lebanon was part of the ceasefire agreement or not, given that Lebanon is not taking part in the negotiations, and this is something between Iran and the United States. I was speaking with government officials all day to try and find out, and they seemed very keen to use this opportunity to push a diplomatic off-ramp to end this war, which has been going on for over a month right now. But by afternoon, we heard dozens, about a dozen airstrikes in the center of Beirut in general, in crowded neighborhoods, commercial areas, residential areas without warning. And we soon found out, according to the Israeli military, that they targeted some, what they said were 100 Hezbollah command and control centers in Beirut, in southern Lebanon, and in eastern Lebanon. This is the largest scale attack we have had since the beginning of the war, and in the entire war probably. And they're still pulling bodies out of the rubble, and we're unsure what's going to happen next. The Lebanese government has been critical of the Israeli strikes, but they've also been very critical of Hezbollah for the rocket attacks. And they've been scrambling for days saying that they want to negotiate. We don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know if this is the beginning of the end or the beginning of a far greater escalation that's going to further pulverize the country.
Do we know what the status is of Hezbollah attacks on Israel? how many are getting through?
Hezbollah has claimed a lot of attacks on a daily basis, whether it's rockets into northern Israel, sometimes quite deep into northern Israel, or whether it's in clashes with ground forces in Israel's invasion of southern Lebanon. However, Hezbollah has not attacked Israel just yet, nor have they claimed anything yet. They sort of approached the ceasefire agreement with caution. They didn't really say very much, but they did threaten that if the ceasefire is not adhered, they would continue their attacks. But they've kept very quiet. We are expecting some sort of response from Hezbollah or some sort of resumption of missile attacks from them. But so far, we haven't heard anything yet.
And the situation, you talked there about bodies being pulled out of the rubble in Lebanon. What about the displacement of civilians? What's the scale of that? And what kind of places are being targeted?
So around the time of the strikes, I was actually in an interview with the social affairs minister of Lebanon, who's spearheading the entire humanitarian response. There's about 1.2 million displaced people. That's roughly 20% of the population. And only a small percentage of them, just over 100,000 or 130,000 or so, are staying in these public schools turned shelters. One of them is even a football stadium. It has about 1,000 people in there. But a lot of the people of those 130,000 are actually staying in the neighborhoods that were struck today in that part of central Beirut. So we're expecting a widening displacement crisis. Lebanese government doesn't have a lot of funding. It's been going through a crippling economic crisis for years and has only been able to secure about 30% of its funding needs. So it's quite a mess. There are people on the streets staying in tents by the seaside promenade. And in other places as well. Some people have a bit more money, are renting out places or staying with friends and family in apartments. And you can tell if you go to Beirut that the traffic has, you know, quadrupled, and there are people who are sleeping on the streets and not knowing when they will go home or if they will ever go home.
And what is the, I mean, I'm trying to think of the timescale here, really, because obviously we're talking about the situation in Iran, which erupted, I think it was the 28th of February or so, but the situation in Lebanon has been going on for some time. What is the timescale now that we're talking about?
So the last war between Israel and Hezbollah ended in late November 2024 through a Washington brokered ceasefire agreement. Now, this never really went into full effect. Israel accused Hezbollah of not really fully withdrawing from southern Lebanon. And Hezbollah was critical of Israel's near daily strikes that continued, albeit on a much smaller scale than in the peak of the war. On March 2nd, this is a couple of days after Iran's Supreme Leader Khamenei was killed in U.S. and Israeli strikes, Hezbollah launched a handful of rockets in northern Israel in solidarity with Iran. And this sparked this latest escalation, which, of course, in Lebanon, they were very, supported it, but there's also large opposition to Hezbollah, and they accuse Hezbollah of dragging the country into another war. So all this has happened in just in a month and 6 days.
Karim, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on the situation in Beirut. That's Karim Chahayeb. He's a journalist at the Associated Press, and he was speaking to us from Beirut. We were asking earlier when the Strait of Hormuz was going to open after this temporary ceasefire deal. According to Reuters, Iran has told ships, all the ships that are queued there, some of the ships are trying to cross, I don't know, that the Strait of Hormuz is still closed. So Iran's saying to the ships that are presumably lined up there and have been for many weeks now that the Strait of Hormuz is not open yet. Let's hope that it does open soon, because that is, of course, part of the deal. Any more update on that, we'll bring that to you here, of course. Now, with the world's attention fixed on the war in Iran, Israeli settler gangs are rapidly and violently expanding outposts in the West Bank, seemingly with impunity. So what is it like on the ground? Is the Israeli government softening to the extremist settler movement, and will settlers be held accountable? Today's The Story podcast looks at that in depth. Manveen Rana has been speaking to Richard Spencer, a world affairs correspondent for The Times.
Under Israeli law, those settler outposts are illegal. Why are they growing unchecked? Is it just that the IDF is distracted?
I mean, that's what they would say. I mean, a more cynical view is that it is the aim of a large part of the Israeli political spectrum. There's sympathy across, the more hardline parts of the Likud party for the idea that the West Bank certainly will not be granted statehood. We know that Netanyahu and other ministers in his government have set their stall very much against the granting of Palestinian statehood. And whether that means they're actively pursuing annexation, de facto annexation, but that's what it looks like. It looks like any opportunity can be used to extend Israeli control over more and more of the West Bank.
That was The Times' Richard Spencer speaking to Manveen Rana. And you can hear more on the Story podcast. That is One Story, told in depth each day. It's available free wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, coming up, can Rory McIlroy create more Augusta history by winning back-to-back green jackets? It's 3:22.
Aisha Hazarika on Times Radio.
Trusted quality reporting from the heart of Westminster.
I've actually just hot-footed it from Parliament. I sat in for the first hour or so.
From momentous world events to everyday life.
Over the next hour, we'll be talking to the man behind the TV show that everyone has been talking about, and I mean everyone.
And the views that need to be heard.
This kind of standoff is not good for doctors, it's not good for patients, it's not good for the whole of the NHS.
Aisha Hazarika, every Friday afternoon from 1. On Times Radio.
Right now, a guide dog puppy is taking her very first steps. One day, she'll help someone with sight loss live a full and independent life.
Find the crossing, Bess. Good girl.
When you sponsor a puppy with guide dogs, you're there for it all. Her wobbly walks, her first harness, the life-changing partnership. It's more than a donation. It's the start of a life-changing story. Search Sponsor a Guide Dog Puppy and be part of a story you'll be proud to share.
Guide dogs.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. This is Times Radio.
Let me just tell you about Times Money, because it has wealth tools, expert columnists, real life stories and lots of really valuable financial insight and advice. It brings everything together that you need to know about money in one place. Just go to thetimes.com/money to get started. Now, this is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover all this week. Coming up after 3:30, the best-selling children's author Anjali Rauf. And every week on the show, you can hear lots of great interviews with brilliant guests. And if you miss it, you don't have to worry, because you can listen to it on Jane and Fee's hit podcast, Off Air. You can hear all of their 3:30 interviews in full, including Sean Williams, Nancy Birtwistle, Zach Goldsmith and Jenny Godfrey. Recently, they spoke to the poet, the legendary poet, Pam Ayres. Now, the world can be a pretty bleak place, and Pam's poetry is very funny and comforting. And Jane asked Pam if she's often moved to poetry by current affairs.
Well, I snipe from the sidelines on Twitter, as it used to be. And I didn't ever want to go on Twitter or X as it is now, because I didn't see the point. But what it's actually given me the opportunity to do is comment on topical things. So I've had a few swipes at Donald Trump and tax and topical things. So I do have a bit of fun with it, but not in an ominous way, and not in a serious political way. I have a bit of fun with current events, but there isn't much to have fun with now.
Not right now. I mean, the thing about Trump, there are many things about Trump. His name, it's got to be good for a rhyme.
Mm. Well, the last swipe I took at Donald Trump was about when he said, in order to overcome COVID, you should inject yourself with bleach. And I thought that was so hysterical. I thought I must have a go at that. So that was good fun. But I don't comment seriously on politics. I think other people are much better placed to do that than me. I try and make people smile.
That was the poet Pam Ayres. You can download that. Many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. Right, it's 3:26 now. A year after the greatest moment of his career, Rory McIlroy is returning to Augusta in the hope of winning back-to-back green jackets. He completed the career Grand Slam in golf when he won the Masters last year. So after years of being asked when he's going to win, what's the story now? Sports journalist Hugo Chambray joins me. Hi, Hugo.
Afternoon, Asma.
He says that there's still a lot he wants to do. So where do you go after a career Grand Slam?
Yeah, I mean, when Rory McIlroy walked into the Champions press conference after winning the Masters last year, getting this monkey off his back, I mean, literally 15 years in the making, he posed that question to reporters. He said, kind of, every year the story is about me going into the Masters, so what are we all going to talk about next year? And so here we are next year, and that is the big question. What are we going to talk about? Is Rory McIlroy going to become only the fourth man ever in history to win back-to-back green jackets? And he'd be joining the company of Jack Nicklaus, Nick Faldo, Tiger Woods. I mean, seriously, an impressive achievement were he able to do that. And he's talking the talk of a man who's relaxed, who's not feeling the pressure that was clearly on him for so many years. I mean, there's been multiple documentaries that have come out, and he's spoken a lot about, you know, just how heavily that expectation weighed. But now he's got it off him. What's going to be the reaction, and can he do it all over again?
So, I mean, this is all relative, but less pressure then than before. Yes, you know, it's back to back. That's the hope. But, you know, it sounds like it was harder and a longer kind of journey to get to the Grand Slam.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say relative pressure. I mean, he's still competing against the best golfers in the world. It's still an incredibly tough golf course. And there's an argument that pressure can be a motivator. It can focus the mind as a professional athlete, as a top sports person. You know, it can dial you in to those fine margins to really perform at the level you're capable of. So it will be really interesting to see when the Masters gets underway tomorrow morning, if Rory McIlroy can, you know, achieve this incredible thing, win it would be a sixth major championship. That would put him up in revered company as well. But there's plenty of other contenders in the mix, the likes of Scottie Scheffler. Bryson DeChambeau's been talking about the rivalry that he has now with McIlroy and said he wants to beat the living daylights out of him every time they play against each other. So yeah, there's a lot to be looking forward to.
The Times also writes about how Augusta is more than golf, and that the rest of the city is very different, really, to the glitz and the glam of the Masters. I don't know much about Augusta. Tell me.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece, this, by Rick Broadbent in the Times. And Augusta is, well, the Masters is one of the top 10 annual sporting events in the calendar. But you also have to remember that it's in Georgia. It's in the deep south of America. And it's also a golf club, probably the most exclusive golf club in the United States. So some examples: for the first 50 years that the Masters was played, only black men caddied and only white men played in the Masters. Yeah. It didn't have a black member until 1990. Women protested the club in 2003 because it didn't have a single female member. It finally admitted its first one in 2012. And that's just inside the walls of the golf club. Out of 182 US cities, Augusta was ranked 177th for job prospects, 181st for women's safety, and it was 10th for in terms of neediness, so in terms of economic disadvantage. So it really does have this juxtaposition. Now there's a question of whether the golf club should be responsible for trying to uplift the city, and it does give back in some ways. It contributes to a local college's female golf program. But yeah, it certainly is a stark disparity. And another thing that Rick points out is that Augusta National has bought $280 million of neighbouring property in the last 25 years to sort of try and expand the horizons of the golf club. And obviously that has knock-on effects to the local community as well.
Yeah, absolutely. fascinating. Thank you for that, Hugo. Hugo Chambray there. If you want more on those stories, including that piece we were just talking about, go to thetimes.com and head to the sports section, of course. Right, coming up, big interview with a best-selling author and activist, Anjali Rauf. First, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Daisy Steele.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth claims America has decimated Iran's military. He's been speaking at the Pentagon after the US and Israel agreed a two-week pause in the fighting as long as the Strait of Hormuz stays open.
Iran has been a threat to the United States and the free world for 47 years. Chance of death to America, targeting our people, killing Americans, lying and blackmailing their way toward a nuclear weapon, so they thought. No longer. Not on our watch.
Meanwhile, the US president says any country supplying weapons to Iran will be immediately taxed 50% on goods sold to America. Having announced the two-week ceasefire, Donald Trump says they're working with Iran to remove what he's calling buried nuclear dust, adding there'll be no enrichment of uranium. It comes as Lebanon says it's under the heaviest bombardment of the war so far, after Israel claimed to have targeted 100 Hezbollah targets inside 10 minutes. In other news, it's been decided the BBC broke its editorial rules when it broadcast a racial slur uttered by a Tourette's campaigner. It aired during February's BAFTA Film Awards ceremony. And the RSPCA says more than 250 poodle cross dogs overran a UK home after owners lost control of breeding, leaving animals in filthy, overcrowded conditions. Dozens have now been rescued, as the charity warns a sharp rise in large-scale neglect cases is pushing centres to capacity. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
The To-Do List. Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris. This is Times Radio.
And this is Asma Mir on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. It is 3:34 now. If you have children, they may well have read the best-selling book, The Boy at the Back of the Class by Anjali Rauf. It's about a young Syrian refugee who arrives in the UK without his parents. And the book describes how some of the children in his class try to help him find them. Now, as a writer, Anjali's stories do not shy away from difficult topics. Instead, they try to open up conversations, encouraging children to ask questions, to show a bit of empathy, and to try to better understand the world they're growing up in. The book has now been adapted for the stage and it is touring the country. But Anjali is not just a writer. She's also the founder of a women's rights organisation. She's led refugee aid convoys and continues to campaign on issues from domestic violence to food poverty, both issues that have affected her own family. And as if that wasn't enough, she has been awarded an MBE. So Anjali, welcome to you.
Hello, Asma. Hi, nice to be here.
Now, The Boy at the Back of the Class, I know it wasn't written that long ago, but it's, in my mind, it's a bit of a classic because I see it in every bookshop. And believe me, I go to a lot of bookshops, not just for myself, but for my daughter too. It won loads of prizes. But you wrote it, I know you wrote it in 2 months, which is phenomenal. But the idea for the whole story came from a really unforgettable encounter that you had. Tell us a bit about that encounter.
So I began working in the refugee camps of France, if we can call them camps, in 2015. And about a year into the works, I met this baby called Rayhan, who the book is dedicated to. And I met him for about 20 minutes. Got to hold him, got to take a picture, and just as we were leaving, and my team and I were saying we'll be back in the evening, we'll try and arrange some kind of respite and medical care for the mother, we suddenly realised that there was a clearance about to happen, and when I talk about clearance, that means the police are allowed to come in and destroy anything they see within a campsite. That includes tents, sleeping bags, phones, shoes, whatever they find. And of course, the refugees run for their life. So as we were leaving, the police were entering, and I've never seen that baby since that day. Now, at this point, I had no intention of writing a book, but I went back home. I fell very ill. I ended up in hospital about 3 months later. And I've got this photo of this baby on my phone, and I had it printed out and put on my desk. And all I could think about was what was going to happen to this little baby, what was going to happen to him if he ever became a 7, 8, 9-year-old, has spent most of his life running, being told he doesn't belong anywhere, he doesn't deserve anything, and finally made it into a country that wasn't chasing him, but did so alone, and finally walked into a classroom for the first time ever in his life. Who was he going to meet? Was he going to meet people who would never understand him, who would bully him for who he was and what his skin colour was and where he'd come from? Or would he meet someone rather spectacular? So the narrator is that someone rather spectacular.
So what's the time lapse between you having that experience and writing the book?
Once I got the idea into my head, it was 7 weeks writing it. And I think the time lapse was round about probably 8 weeks from meeting the baby to having the idea.
And how soon did it get published after you'd finished it?
It was a little bit miraculous. So I had an agent by this time. Before I wrote the book, I was actually writing a trilogy around chocolate, because chocolate is the best thing to investigate and research. And I had an agent, and she was trying to sell the chocolate books. And I wrote this book in 7, 8 weeks, and I sent it off to her. And I said, look, I don't know if anything will happen with this. It's just a short story I've written, short to me. And I handed it in, and she sold it in 2 weeks.
Well, there you go. What happened to the chocolate books?
It's still ongoing. Hasn't sold yet, so I'll go back to that one.
But you have written, since The Boy at the Back of the Class, you've written another 8 books.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, roughly.
So there
we
go.
Yeah.
Some people might say, well, hang on a minute, you know, children who might be 8 or 9, can they really wrap their heads around migration and refugees and racism and that kind of stuff? Obviously you believe they can, but try to persuade someone who might not think that's right.
So, Asma, I think one of the first emails I ever got after the book came out was actually from a really angry father who wrote in saying, this book, my child has come home with it and is really upset, and I don't think you should write this kind of topic for children. It's absolutely unsuitable. And I wrote back and I said, your child is very aware, more than I was when I was their age, of what situation the world is in. They are aware of wars going on. They know there are bombs dropping. They know there are people fleeing. Isn't it better if your child grew up understanding the person fleeing, if they could understand and have a safe place to ask questions? Because that's what books are, we're a safe place to ask questions. So my whole kind of premise around children, you know, shouldn't know about this stuff, shouldn't be talking about this stuff, they know already. They're hyper-aware. They're inundated with really negative, horrific news. I think the statistic is around 78% of children go to bed really anxious about the world and what grown-ups are doing to it. So if we can provide stories, if we can provide characters and also solutions in those stories, then maybe we can do some good.
Did the father reply?
No.
No. Okay, that's a shame. I thought this was going to be like a beautiful conversation that went on,
but I have far more lovely letters coming in, so it's totally fine.
I'm sure you do. Now, it was adapted for the stage 2 years ago.
Yes.
How involved were you in that? That must be really difficult. You know, you write a book and then someone kind of takes it away and does stuff to it.
I'm lucky because the guy who took it away and did stuff to it was Nick Cahard, who's a BBC presenter, and he came in, and I was very fortunate because I don't think many authors are allowed to kind of sit side by side almost with the creative team and with the adapter and go through everything. But Nick saw the story in ways that I could never have seen it. There's a flip moment in the play which nobody is expecting, where Ahmet's voice comes at the fore and he turns into this lion creature almost, which is amazing. But it was hard in some moments because there's so many scenes in the book, of course, we can't put in the play.
Yeah.
But there's also so many things we could do because you could, you know, turn 1,000 words into a single expression, which is incredible. So it's really surreal to sit and watch the play bring the book to life.
And what, when kids, and obviously adults as well, but when kids come to watch it, what
how engaged are they with it? How, you know, because kids love, they love going to the theatre. I mean, they absolutely love it just because they're out of school.
Yes.
You know, they can be a bit rowdy. Yeah. How did they kind of interact with the play?
Well, it's quite interesting. When kids are with their friends and it's a school outing, it's really, really loud. I don't know how the actors get through it, but the actors have to react as they go as well. And with the parents, so I was at the South Bank watching it yesterday, when they're with the parents and grandparents, they're very subdued, they're very quiet, very contemplative, on their best behaviour, so to speak, so it's less rowdy. But there is still an interaction going on. There's questions asked throughout the play, and you suddenly get kids going, I do, or yes, I do, or, you know, and you hear a conversation starting up between themselves. So it's really beautiful. I love it.
I'm really interested in how you kind of started writing, because I know you were writing for, you're a very determined person from what I've read, because you were working loads of other jobs and you were basically writing for 17 years.
Yes.
And then also you were trying to, was it Oxford that you were determined to get into?
Yes.
And you got there in the end for a master's, I think it was. But tell me a bit about when you understood that you loved books. How did that happen and who encouraged you? Or was it just in you?
I think it was a combination of, it was already in me from, I don't know, almost like my grandmother and my mother. I grew up watching my mother reading. I grew up watching my mother instill in us that, you know, we're here for you to have your best education. That's the reason why we are going through so many things. And I don't know, because you have a daughter. Is she a reader? Does she love to read?
She's obsessive.
Absolutely.
Reader. She's reading The Hunger Games right now.
Oh, my God.
And
how old is she?
She's only 10. Is that too young for her?
No, of course not. That's amazing. So I was a complete bookworm from a very young age. And I would read whenever I could. And I think it's my mum, really. And also I had an amazing teacher called Miss Kumi. She's the one that made me want to be a writer, because she is the one who never poo-pooed a story I came to school with. And also she's, I don't know, we had reading time. So we had reading time 20 minutes a day, just before the home time bell, and Miss Kumi would get out puppets and make voices and just make all the stories come to life. And I was like, oh my God, one day, I think I was about 7 or 8, I'm going to write a story good enough for Miss Kumi to read to her next class.
Oh, wow.
So she made me really want to become a writer. And then my mum kind of took it one step further and said, yeah, you if that's what you want to do, you have to go for it, but you have to do it alone. You're going to have to do this alone.
And what does she mean by that?
I think she meant that as an immigrant family and facing the kind of racism you do, that you don't really get many, I don't know, pathways, I suppose.
Okay.
Those are going to be easy for you. So she was always very much like, you know, if you're going to want to do something, you're going to have to fight for it.
Mm.
Whether it was getting into Oxford, whether it was getting into jobs, whether it was becoming a writer, you'll have to fight for it and you have to continue fighting for it. So I knew that from a very young age. I think that's what made me stubborn.
Yeah. But would you say that it was a fight?
Absolutely. Because I think if you're a complete and utter outsider to any industry, if you're trying to break through a wall or a door, you're going to have to find ways to do that on your own terms. And for me, that came in the form of a chocolate box. So I was sending out the manuscript for 9-10 years. I was going through, there's a writing illustrator's guidebook, just going from A to P, literally going from A onwards to Z. I hit P, and that took me about 9 years. And I thought, oh my God, I'm just getting standard rejection letters. What do I do? So I thought, okay, my book's about chocolate. I'm going to put in a chocolate book, such a chocolate box. So I spent a fortune on Thornton's chocolate box because they were big enough for me to put my manuscript in. And I tie it up in a really big ribbon, address it to the editor, and all the editors started to write back saying this was a really hilarious idea. So they were still rejecting me, but I started to get notes from them. And then my agent, who I'm with now, Sylvia, she thought it was the most funniest thing on the planet and she loved the script. And here I am today.
I also read in some of the stuff I was reading, and I'm not surprised by this, but then a little bit of me is that when you were being encouraged as a child to read more and to write more, there were some people within the Bangladeshi community who were saying, why are you wasting your time letting her do that stuff? But I don't mean to be ignorant about that stuff, because again, all Asian experiences are very different.
Mm-hmm.
But what was so dangerous about reading and writing?
I don't think it's the reading and writing. I think it's the dream of having jobs related to it.
Okay.
I think it's to do with security. It's to do with, well, actually, maths will serve you better and law will serve you better. And, you know, the whole kind of, why aren't you an accountant? What are you doing with your life? Like, you know,
I see.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, it's not to do with the actual topic. But I think there was question marks around, what's she going to do with an English degree? What on earth is she going to do with that? Is she going to become a teacher? That's the only job you can do with an English degree. And it was always like, well, no, I want to do a little bit more with the English degree. So let me go and do that.
diversity in publishing, some people just don't, it doesn't occur to them and they don't actually think it makes any difference or it's important. Now, it might be important for, you know, 14-year-old Anjali and 14-year-old me and my 10-year-old, but it's not important for everyone. They just don't see it. So can you explain why it might be important, to have a character that's not... that doesn't look like the majority of people.
I think it's the only portal, I think, for a lot of people to meet other worlds. If you're not seeing yourself, if you're not seeing other people that you might not meet daily in books, then how on earth are you going to learn anything? So I think for 14-year-old you and 10-year-old me and your daughter and my nephews and nieces, I am envious of the world they're growing up in because they see the possibilities, and I think it will be less of a fight. And that's why we fight, right? So that for our future generations, it won't be so big a fight. It might still be a struggle, but it won't be as big a fight. And when I think about the generations, what my mum went through versus what I'm going through, wow, what she went through, I don't think I could survive it. But what I'm now able to go and do is because of what she fought for. So I don't want to pry too much,
but what did your mum go through?
So I think there's just a lot of racism around what she was trying to do. She was working for lots of charities at times. She's an amazing mathematician. She has 2 degrees. She's never, you know, she was never promoted in her work. She was kind of facing a lot of backlash against just, you know, for being who she is and her skin colour and the fact that she wears a hijab. So the kind of exterior becomes everything to some people, and books are the way to break that down. And so we're as human, as funny, as poetic, as historically rich as everybody else. So let us be seen and come meet us.
Let's talk a bit about your other work. You're the founder of 2 NGOs, Making Her Story, a women's rights organisation tackling the abuse and trafficking of women and girls in the UK, and O's Refugee Aid Team, which raises awareness and funds to support refugee frontline aid organizations. What difference do organizations like that make? What's their kind of bread and butter?
Well, with both the organizations, they were kind of set up unexpectedly so. So I never thought I was ever going to set up a women's rights organisation because I thought there's so many. Why would I need to? But I faced a really life-changing event in 2011, which kind of upended my trust in a lot of organisations that I believed would be supportive of women facing domestic violence, especially who were trying to flee for their lives. And I really began it as a book club. So Making Her Story began as a book club to raise money for local women's refuges who were coming to us saying, well, actually, we don't just need funds. Could you send us some toothbrushes? Could you send us some bed sheets? Could you send us some pajamas? And it was my first kind of like, why do you need toothbrushes and bed sheets and pajamas? Isn't that what the government will pay for?
But this is all to do with your cousin.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about her.
Because I was so young when I met her. But tell
us her name as well. Her name needs to be out there, doesn't it?
Yes, Ruma Jannat. So she was just the most softly spoken, Bollywood loving, romantic soul you could ever meet. And I met her when she phoned my family from a women's refuge. That's the first time we got to know her because we have huge families. We don't know half of them. And she rang through and she was trying to escape a very abusive husband. She had 2 young little baby girls. She had managed to flee from her abuser, make her way to a police station, make her way into a refuge. And when I kind of started to hear her story, you know, the family obviously stepped right up and would try to help as much as possible. But for 5.5 years, she fought for her life, for freedom. And she was failed by pretty much everyone from social services to the judicial system to the policing system. And she ended up, you know, having her worst fear realised, which was that he was going to kill her. She warned the judges, she warned the police, and they just poo-pooed it. And I think we have on record one judge telling her in Bow County Court, you're just being a really silly woman. He's going to anger management, blah-de-blah-de-blah. So after that happened, I fell into like a really deep depression. I thought, okay, I can't sit back and I read her homicide review case, and there were so many agencies that knew what was going on, but none of them shared the information with each other. None of them shared the information with her. So it meant that she went to court with nothing to back her. And I thought, what is this red tape around information? Why is it that women are forced to enter courts alone when they're trying to save their own lives? And of course, there was an element of racism in what she faced as well. So I just thought, okay, the only thing I can do is really get up and do something. I can't just cry and wallow. I need to do something. So I set up Making Her Story. I thought, okay, my aunt's name. I set up a book club. We'll come and talk about feminism and talk about what's going on in the world. We'll raise a few pounds and we'll send those pounds off to women's refuges. And it just is kind of that saying, like, you build something and people come and things start to happen. Yeah. And it just grew and grew and grew. And we started to realise that actually refugees need more than just money. People were coming to us for help. They weren't going to the police. They were coming to us asking for numbers. Where do I go? Because so-and-so is in trouble or I'm in trouble. Mm. And it just started becoming something much bigger than I ever envisioned. And now we work behind the scenes with a lot of agencies that are working to stop trafficking, to stop an unidentified domestic abuse gaps, if you like. UK Feministo is working in schools to try and end sexism. So we're working with them to try and, you know, hype that up. So it's just, there's a lot of things we are trying to do behind the scenes.
You're doing an awful lot. Goodness me. Domestic violence, that found its way into one of your books, didn't it? That was the theme of one of your books. Yeah. Say the name again.
Star Outside My Window. It was my second book.
And what other issues have you, for people who don't know, because I could say you've written 9 books, what other issues have you woven into your books?
So the Starts of My Window, I wanted to tackle domestic violence and ending in femicide from a child's angle, because I think children's voices are completely lost in every aspect and platform when it comes to anything to do with domestic violence. My third book, Night Bus Hero, centres on homelessness, and it's narrated by a bully, because I want to also tackle why do bullies bully. Mm. My fourth book is around historical racisms. So World War II, I grew up loving history. That was my like second favourite subject, and I would open and just delve into history books like anything. But I was always confused. I was like, where are we? When we talk about World War I, World War II, where's the Indian soldiers? Where are the African soldiers? Where are the soldiers from Brazil? Where are the soldiers from Singapore and Burma? So that book, The Line Above the Door, tackles historical racisms and was inspired by a World War II soldier called Tan Kai Hai, who I now have a campaign for to be recognised, because he was just an incredible, amazing Singaporean soldier who's never been recognised. And so all of the books have something involved. I don't know if you wanted me to go through the rest of them, but there's a lot, so I'll leave it there.
I think you are, what's the word, you're prolific, are you not? How many more books have you got in you, do you think?
I think I'll continue writing until the end of my days. Whether or not they'll ever get published, I don't know. I think I have stories coming out of me that won't make it into a book. But I'll keep on writing, and if I am lucky enough to get more published, then I'll try my best.
I'm really interested in your feminism, because, again, I read somewhere that you said you were a feminist since the age of 7, was it? Something like that. I mean, I always say that was a kind of discovered that maybe around the age of 12 or 13, but you've beaten even me. What is the place? Again, I mean this from a good place, because there's people listening who might not know. What is a place of feminism in Muslim communities?
Well, it's really interesting, because I regard Islam as a feminist religion. It's been, you know, it's kind of at the core of it. It's about women's rights. The last speech of our final prophet, Prophet Muhammad, was about women's rights. And it was a warning to the Ummah, you know, the people of the faith, that if you do not respect the rights of women, which is what I've come for, which is what the Quran is centrally about. We've got Miriam in there, you know, Mary, the mother of Jesus, a whole chapter dedicated to her. There's no one else who's been afforded that height of respect. You know, you can't force a girl to marry. Women have the rights to education. This was all 1400 years ago.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a very feminist religion. And I think what's been twisted and turned, of course, is the kind of egotistical, misogynistic power plays that still go on to this day. And we're seeing it heightened in so many platforms. So it's feminism at the core of it. It's feminism is, at the end of the day, equal rights, equal access. And that's what the Quran, I believe, gives all women. So it's up to us to fight for that. And I'm not, when I say us, it's men and women. And if you are dismissing that from Islam, then you don't know Islam.
How many men do you know who would say that they are feminists?
In my family, a lot, because we brought them up that way. But I think we still have a long way to go to make scholars and to make people who run certain, you know, community aspects of our lives, whether it's mosques, whether it's madrasas, whether it's education system, our own education system, if you take, you know, just baseline. Mm. We still have a long way to go to ensure that women's histories are respected, that women's place and contributions to the world are respected. And that's for all communities of all faiths, regardless of who we are. But yeah, we have a long way to go. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying you're responsible for what's going on in Afghanistan, but that's an example that some people look
at. They're not Muslim. Well, if you are taking, you know, if you are daring to use the word of God to suppress, you know, the female, then who are you? What do you believe? Then we don't regard disregard them as anything of anyone of faith can do that to another human being.
Mm. Tell, for people who are listening who want to see the boy at the back of the class, where can they see it? When can they see it?
So it's playing this week at the South Bank, right here in London. And then it's going to move on to Salford. It's going to be in Cornwall. It's going to be in Blackpool. And then it's going to be ending in Bradford. So we have a few more, I think a month and a half left of the tour. And then we'll be having a bit of a rest.
And would you be interested in getting any of your other books being adapted for stage as well?
All of them to be adapted. All of them, please. I mean, come on, that'd be amazing. That'd be the dream come true.
Finally, who do you currently read?
So I usually have 3 or 4 books on the go. Right now, I'm reading a lot of Amy Tan, because I think that what she's done in terms of bringing Chinese history and feminist kind of historical women to the forefront is really interesting. I love her biographical stance and everything. I also read a lot of books by, I don't know if you know the Persephone range.
They're
kind of grey covers. They're really beautiful. So the Persephone Publishing House, what they do is they publish stories by women who've been forgotten. So beautiful, sort of like Monica Dickens and like Frances Hodgson Burnett, who actually wrote a lot of stories, not just Secret Garden, Princess. She wrote beautiful stories for adults as well. So I love to read that range in the morning and then something biographical in the evening.
And do you read children's books?
Yes, I do. Yeah. A lot. Yeah. So Frank Cottrell Boyce always makes me laugh. Benjamin Zephaniah's poetry is just standard in my house. I'll read the classics. I'll read Sita Brahmachari. I'll read Nicola Davis. Like just the most, she's currently the Welsh poet laureate. So she's amazing as well. So yeah. Whatever I can get my hands on.
Well, you're an avid writer and reader, clearly, and you started off like that, and you still are.
Yeah,
you're really impressive. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
It's amazing
kind.
To meet you, actually. Like I say, your name has existed on a book that my daughter loves for years, so it's lovely to meet you, Anjali.
Thank you.
That is Anjali Rife, of course, and it is now Times Radio 3:57.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get the Google Pixel 10 Pro XL on the UK's best network. Press to talk it out live with Gemini, your AI assistant from Google, and find out how to revive that plant. Yep, we've all been there. Plus, you'll stay connected even when you run out of data. Get yours on EE today.
Results for illustrative purposes and may vary. Check responses for accuracy. Eligibility, credit check and terms apply. Credit by EE Limited. Verify best network at ee.co.uk/claims.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Almost at the end of the programme now. Thank you so much for your texts and your emails. A lot of you still talking about the main story of the day, of course, which is this 2-week temporary ceasefire between Iran and America. Although while we're on air, we did hear that Iran had told vessels that the Strait of Hormuz is not open. Perhaps it is going to soon. Mike has got in touch to say Trump has exposed the Iran threat and the region has woken up to it. They will prepare for the future. Starmer has shown his weaknesses. And another one here, this is still an ultimatum scenario under the cover of a ceasefire. And if Iran doesn't comply with a negotiated surrender of sorts, the bombing resumes. Your guest was under the misapprehension that Iran has a choice and the old-style diplomacy is happening again. Many of you, of course, wanting to get in touch about that, and you will continue to throughout the afternoon here on Times Radio, of course. That is it from me. My producer was Hannah Quinn. The technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Asma. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive and the headlines. US Secretary of War Pete Hegseth claims we have a real chance of peace after what he calls a capital V military victory over Iran. And the head of NHS England says resident doctors' strikes have been deliberately timed to cause havoc as the six-day walkout entered its second day. And coming up, former National Security Advisor to Donald Trump, Ambassador John Bolton's going to be joining me live from Washington to talk about the ceasefire, which is being claimed as a victory by both sides. Now, with the world watching the Strait of Hormuz, I'll talk to the organisation responsible for the safety of global shipping. And Keir Starmer arrives in Saudi Arabia. We'll be getting the latest from the Times newsroom, their reporter Ollie Cole.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Daisy Steele.
Good afternoon. US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth says there's a real chance at peace after a conditional two-week ceasefire with Iran, following what he called a decisive military campaign. Donald Trump insists Iran's nuclear capability has been dismantled, with both sides claiming victory. But Bill Kristol, a Republican who worked in George W. Bush's administration, told Times Radio the US is clearly stronger militarily than Iran, even if the decision to strike was not the right one.
We're a much stronger nation than Iran. So, of course, if we attack Iran, we're going to inflict more damage than we suffered. And we did. It was not, however, a justified attack, in my view. It certainly didn't follow constitutional procedures here in the United States. The damage that's been done to the U.S. political process as a result has been very great. Trump's threats of, in effect, genocide against the Iranian people, he didn't follow through. But even making the threat is unbelievably damaging, I think.
It comes as Lebanon says it's under the heaviest bombardment of the war so far, after Israel claimed to have struck 100 Hezbollah targets inside 10 minutes. The head of NHS England says resident doctors' strikes have been deliberately timed to cause havoc as the six-day walkout entered its second day. Hospitals are struggling to fill rotas, with senior clinicians cancelling leave over the Easter holidays to cover gaps, while public support for the action appears to be falling. Former doctor and author of This Is Going to Hurt told Adam Kay told Times Radio that although he backs the strikes, poor messaging means many patients are growing weary of the disruption.
I do not think that their PR has been very good. And I think it's sad that they've gone from, I would say, almost universal goodwill towards what they were saying and doing to the point where the public are fed up. So, yeah, I absolutely see where public sentiment has, you know, how and why it's moved. It doesn't alter the fact that on a personal individual basis, I still stand with my former colleagues.
An investigation into the BBC's coverage of this year's BAFTA Film Awards has found the broadcast of a racial slur was a clear breach of their editorial standards. The Executive Complaints Unit agreed it was a genuine mistake, given that the same word was edited out by the team later in the programme. The average price of a house in the UK fell by 0.5% in March. Analysis by Halifax suggests it was the first month prices fell this year, after rises in January and February. Last month, the average house price was just under £300,000. Bosses at the lender say the slowdown has been triggered by the conflict in the Middle East. And the RSPCA says it rescued dozens of dogs from a UK home overrun by more than 250 poodle crosses, known as doodles, after the owners lost control of breeding. Officials found the property in filthy conditions with unkempt animals and waste covering the floors. The charity is warning large-scale neglect cases are rising sharply. It's urging people to adopt as centres struggle to cope with demand. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Good to have you with us. Donald Trump, then, is calling the Iran war ceasefire a complete victory. And maybe he believes that. His devout supporters are saying the same thing. But a formidable range of experts and leading strategic and diplomatic veterans argue the Middle East conflict has delivered a strategic defeat and a historic failure for the Trump administration, one that's weakened the global economy, that's split and damaged the Atlantic Alliance, and which has undermined the stability on which the Gulf states have model their future. It's surely fair to argue, how does anyone sustainably call this a victory for President Trump after that bone-chilling threat to destroy Iran as a civilization, from which he almost immediately backed down and agreed a two-week ceasefire to discuss terms that he will surely find impossible to accept? Well, we can discuss the answers all we like, which is exactly what we're going to be doing on today's programme. Right now, it looks like there is an agreement to stop the war, at least for now. And Pakistan did its job as an intermediary and cleared the way for both sides to claim total victory, however convincingly or not. Yes, much of Iran's military power has been destroyed, though not all. Iran's nuclear programme was shattered before the war began. President Trump has just posted on social media. He'll discuss lifting sanctions on Iran. Iran is ready, he says, to dig up and hand over the enriched uranium that was buried by last summer's bombing raid. Or was the war necessary to get an agreement on that? And today, with a ceasefire that leaves Iran in control of the vital shipping route, the Strait of Hormuz, even talking of charging millions to use the strait to transport the oil and the commodities that the global economy needs, and with hardliners still in charge in Tehran, with hope of true regime change to remove that brutal theocracy, all but extinguished, does that sound like an American victory to you? It is not a rhetorical question. Tell me what you think. Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, earlier on today, a couple of hours ago, the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, he gave an update on the Iran war. He said Iran had begged for the ceasefire.
No other president has shown the courage and resolve of this commander-in-chief. President Trump forged this moment. Iran begged for this ceasefire, and we all know it. As the president truthed this morning, a big day for world peace. Iran wants it to happen. They've had enough.
Well, Hegseth also praised fulsomely President Trump's efforts towards securing the deal.
Say, you know what, I'd rather talk to you at the table than obliterate your capability to export oil and fund your terror regime. So he did make that choice. That was his choice. He was a president of peace, and he's been willing to make those really tough calls that the American people elected him to do.
Right, so after that, let's just explore the thoughts of Catherine Philp, the Times World Affairs editor. Catherine, lovely to see you.
Hi, John.
So there he is, Trump proclaiming victory with total confidence. He has, after all, Catherine had lots of practice, having proclaimed victory a number of times over past weeks. It's generally, though, is it not hard to objectively sustain that claim?
I think it is objectively hard to sustain that claim. And it's the same claim that Iran is making, and in almost the same hyperbolic language, they're both sides are claiming victory. I think the test will be what happens when negotiators from both sides get together to discuss what are absolutely irreconcilable frameworks. The 15.1 that the US drew up last month against this 10-point plan that the Iranians put forward at the 11th hour through the Pakistanis. Almost every single proposition in that list has already been rejected by the US. And the only two new things in it are, in fact, concerning the control of the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran did not claim before this war began, and a ceasefire in Lebanon, which is obviously the front on which Israel is fighting and